So I'd like to just start out here at the very beginning with his birth, but I'd like to preface that by saying who I think Inayat Khan was. For a long time, we had to have a title for Murshid because Pir Velayat told us it wasn't respectful to speak about him without a title. I never really got it, but I did what he said because he was my teacher. But now, I don't feel we need to do that. I'm perfectly happy calling him Inayat Khan, and that's the way I will refer to him. In his lifetime, everyone called him Murshid. That was the only name he had, was Murshid. Nobody ever called him anything else. But there's a little bit of confusion, particularly in this part of the world, about the word Murshid, because that also refers to Samuel Lewis, customarily. And I don't want to have to say Piro Murshid every time I talk about him, which was his full title and the one he insisted on publicity when he was teaching in the West. There's a story that perhaps you've heard that Paul Reps, the great writer about Zen, who was a murid in the center here in San Francisco and who was Murshid's driver when he went from here down to Southern California and back, with Kismet Stam, his secretary, and Rabia Martin also in the car. Those must have been jolly travels along the coasts of California and so forth. Paul Reps had the Sufi name Saladin, and he reports that he asked Murshid, he said, well, you know, what would you like me to call you? Should I call you Murshid or Mr. Khan or Pir Murshid or, you know, what would you like to be called? And Murshid replied, call me Inayat. Which is quite extraordinary, because in India, you may or may not know, people are never called by their names. It would be very impolite to call anyone by their name. But he apparently, I mean, he liked this name that he had. It means benevolence, and it really kind of summarizes his being, which was consistently benevolent, even in the most difficult circumstances. And he had plenty of difficult circumstances, at least from his own point of view, as he writes about in the little piece called Organization, where he reviews trying to work with Westerners in a spiritual capacity, which was not as easy as you would imagine, particularly for an Indian who was reared on the Indian idea of discipleship, something which Inayat Khan himself said is not possible, he discovered, for men, for male persons in the West. He said, occasionally you could find it among women. But for men, it was just out of the question to have that kind of discipleship, because we are so thoroughly trained in individualism, in the importance of our own point of view, in not letting anybody tell us what to do, all of these things, it makes it impossible for us really to be disciples in that Eastern sense. And it's not a bad thing, it's just a fact. That was not available. And that caused him a lot of difficulties, because it took him a long time to really understand that the people who came to him and, adored him, nevertheless, wouldn't necessarily do what he said, or wouldn't necessarily wouldn't take seriously the things that he advised them, particularly if it had to do with anything worldly, because they consistently made the assumption that Murshid, as a spiritual person, really didn't understand the way the world works, you know. I mean, how could he? He was far, far above all of that. And Murshid himself was, I don't know what the right word would be. I was about to say resentful, but I don't think Murshid was capable of resentment, really. But he was consistently put out by this way of thinking about him, that he couldn't deal with practical things. He may have been wrong about that, I don't know. Pir Velayat considered himself a very practical man. He wasn't by any standard that you can imagine, but that's how he thought of himself. So anyway. So I wanted to say who he is as far as I can see, and that is that, first of all, he was a musician, and I mean that in the sense in which, have you seen the film Tous les matins du monde, All the Mornings of the World? I mean musician in the sense that that it's used in that film. Just being able to play or even write music doesn't make you a musician. Experiencing life as music makes you a musician. So he was first of all a musician, whether he performed music or not. Secondly, he was a mystic. That is simply someone who has a direct experience of the divine. That's a mystic. And Murshid was most certainly a mystic, and the training that he gave was training in mysticism. And third, he was a visionary. That is to say, he was somebody who saw the way things were going and gave us clues as to how to deal with that. That's what a visionary means. And also had a way of understanding the best possible outcome to the situation, a situation which otherwise might lead us to despair. He saw the possibilities in the development of the future and gave us a lot of clues as to how to realize those possibilities. For me, Murshid is a musician, a mystic, and a visionary. And those are the aspects I'm going to emphasize as we go through his life. He was born on the 5th of July, and this is a date that we still celebrate. It's one of the three Sufi holidays. He was born into the context of Islam. I mean, his family were Muslim, although they were far from fanatical Muslims or narrow-minded Muslims. His grandfather, who was the patriarch of the family, known as Mullah Bash, had, in fact, a Muslim wife and a Hindu wife. In fact, when it came time to send him to school, the best school in Baroda, where he lived, Baroda Academy, which was sponsored by the Gaikwad, the Maharaja of Baroda, was the best school in Baroda. But it was a Hindu school. Inayat Khan's family did not hesitate to send their son to the best school. They didn't care if it was Hindu or Muslim or what it was. This would never happen today. No Muslim family would ever think of sending their child to a Hindu school. So things have changed for the worse since Murshid's day. But it also happened to be the teaching in that school happened to be in the Marathi language, the language of Bombay and that area, rather than in the local language, which was Gujarati, or in the sort of fancy Muslim language, which was Urdu. So already at 6 years old, little Inayat had to learn a new language to go to school. He learned English because he had a great interest in English from early childhood. And he used to leave standing orders with the other little boys in Baroda that if any English-speaking tourists showed up, they would come on the train, of course, they should come and get him immediately. And he would go and offer to be a tour guide for these English-speaking people just for the chance of speaking English and learning more English. He learned English by absorption this way and was already fluent in English as a child. There also, in his family, was a great interest in the West because one of his uncles had gone to England, had received a doctorate from the conservatory in London in music, had had further studies in Germany, and had come back to India. Dr. Patan was his name, because they're descended from the Afghan Patan, whom we now call Pashtun. It's the same thing, it's just a different transcription of the word. So they have their origin there, and it actually is pretty obvious when you think about it, because I remember once seeing a photograph of a group of elders in Kabul, and you know, a Pure of Life could have been sitting right in that group and wouldn't have been out of place at all. I mean, they look exactly the same. So this is part of our heritage also, the Pashtun heritage. Dr. Patan had adopted a Western dress. He wore, you know, a tie and jacket and trousers and Western manners. He'd learned to play all the Western instruments. And when he came back from London, they established a new department. The Gayan Shala, that was the great music school started by Mullah Bash, Inayat's grandfather, was dedicated to classical Indian music. But they now initiated a new department of Western music, and where people learn to play Western instruments and to read music in the Western style and all of that. And all of the kids in the family, Inayat included, were wild for the Western things. I mean, this is what they, you know, classical Indian, that's the old stuff. But here it was something new and exciting, and they all had dreams of going to the West and being educated and, you know, making an impression there and so forth. When he was a child, he was extremely naughty. He loved his parents very much, but he wasn't into, doing what they would want. And twice he got other little friends of his and ran away from home. And he was going to go off. Kind of premonition of what happened later. He decided he was going to go and start a music school somewhere else with his little friends. And one time they were gone for 3 days.
Wow.
And when they got back, everybody was extremely upset with him. But he didn't understand why they were upset. It seemed like a perfectly natural thing to him to do. And actually, there's another story from his childhood that I'd like to tell you just briefly. When he was a child, the first piece of theater that he ever saw, and it sparked his interest in theater. You know, he wrote 4 plays later on, and not only wrote them, but had them performed, and he didn't direct the play, but he cast the play. He decided who would play what part, and he took tremendous delight in casting people in roles that were completely opposite to their own personalities, and then he would sit in the front row and laugh and laugh. It was so funny. Inayat was a really excellent student in the subjects that interested him, and those were mainly literary subjects. He was very interested in language, obviously. He wrote poetry already when he was what we would call a grade school child. He showed precocity for the use of language. Unfortunately, we don't have those poems, but he wrote, for example, a hymn in praise of Ganesha, the elephant-headed god, son of Shiva and Parvati. Who is he's probably going around India, you probably see Ganesha more than any other figure, because he's the god of good fortune, of being blessed in whatever enterprise you undertake, and rubbing his elephant nose is considered he's over every doorway. So he's kind of a universal popular god, you might say. And Murshid wrote a hymn to Ganesha. Well, from the viewpoint of Islam, what would you think about that? there's one God, he has no associates, and here's a hymn to Ganesha? I mean, it doesn't wash at all in our current situation of polarization, but then nobody remarked on it at all. They didn't say, well, what are you doing writing hymns to this Hindu God? Or, no, it just wasn't there at all. It was a good poem, and they enjoyed it, and it won a prize. However, in subjects which did not interest him already as a little boy, he just refused to learn. He wouldn't study it, he wouldn't learn it. They beat him, and it didn't make any difference because he had a kind of iron will. He decided something, that was it, and there was no discussion about it. So that, for example, he didn't like arithmetic at all. And I'm convinced, but I could be wrong, that he never did learn basic arithmetic. And as a consequence of that, he never dealt with money. His entire, because you have to know basic arithmetic to do money, right? You can't, otherwise you can't. And I see no evidence anywhere that he ever dealt with money in any way for his whole life. Somebody else had to travel with him with the money and do all of these things. It was, you could say beneath him, but that wasn't his attitude. It just was, he just wasn't interested. And one of the consequences of that is that he never had any money. He was always literally poor and dependent on the goodwill of others for the financial aspect of life. Fortunately, he had a lot of that goodwill, and in fact, he could have had a lot more money. He had there were a lot of offers that he turned down because there were strings attached, and he would not accept any strings. No matter what was being offered, if there was a string attached, he said, thank you very much, but no. With a few people, there were no strings attached, and he did accept that. Like the house that he lived in Suren didn't belong to him, it belonged to this Dutch woman. But she offered it to the family without any strings. Fazel Mai was her name. And she lived there with them. She was the family's kind of adopted grandmother. And they gratefully accepted this because she didn't want anything from Mershit. She didn't want him to do anything. But anybody who did want him to do anything, even if it was something that he was perfectly willing to do himself, he wouldn't accept it because it had to be completely of his own volition that he did things and not because somebody wanted him to or expected him to or anything of that kind. In 1896, when Mershit was 14 years old, his grandfather died in Lubavitch. His grandfather had been the main influence in his life, although he was very close to his parents as well. But Lubavitch was very much the patriarchal figure in this family, and he conducted a kind of in France they would call it a salon. That is to say, people from all over India, philosophers, poets, and musicians would come to Baroda to be with Lubavitch and discuss all the topics of interest to people of that kind. And from a very early age, he would ask Inayat to come and sit next to him in these gatherings, where people were talking way over the head of a child, but and I, from a very early time, had the ability for long concentration. He followed the discussions. He listened carefully to the way people spoke and absorbed it into his own being. But he was just there next to his grandfather all the time. And so the loss of his grandfather was very, very shocking to this young man. It was the main person in his life was now gone. And he entered into a period of when he was suddenly, strangely, very quiet, because he was an incredibly energetic boy. Everyone saw that. And now suddenly he seemed very subdued and not really very interested in things. And because of this, his uncle, Dr. Patan, the one who had studied in the West, had been engaged by the Maharaja, the king in Nepal, as an advisor to musical advisor to his court. And so Inayat's father, Ramat Khan, and some other older members of the family decided to take the boy with them to Kathmandu for a great musical gathering. These kinds of things happened often in the courts of the Maharajas. They didn't really have very much power anymore at this time, but they could patronize the arts on a large scale. And so they had very interesting travels on the way. He visited Varanasi for the first time, for example, and they went obviously overland. It was the only way to go there, through the jungles in southern Nepal. We don't usually think of Nepal as mountains, but there are jungles in the southern part of Nepal. It's actually south of Delhi, if you look at the map, surprisingly enough. And they had adventures going through the jungles, saw tigers, you know, all of these things. And finally, they got to Kathmandu, where they stayed for a very considerable length of time while all of these musical events were taking place. But Yaninayak was disgusted by what he saw of the politics of the court. There were those who were in and those who were out. Those who had come from far away, like his own family, were out. I mean, there was no way they could go in. There were people surrounding the Maharaja who dictated everything. And it wasn't based on talent. It was based on who knew whom and all of these kinds of things. And Young and I was very, very upset about this. He never imagined that such things would take place in the world of music and poetry. And so he took to taking long rides. He loved riding horseback, and there were horses available, so he took to taking long rides out into the countryside to pass his time away from this court. And once, while he was doing this, he had an extraordinary experience. He ran into a remarkable being. There's more than one account of this. One of the other accounts, he refers to this being as a Muni, which means a man who never spoke. But in this account, he calls him a Mahatma, meaning a great, great soul. And it's a wonderful account that he gives here. One day, while traveling over the hills and dales, he saw at a distance someone sitting in a place where scarcely anyone would ever be seen. On arriving there, he found the man was a Mahatma, sitting in silent meditation in that lonely spot, perhaps for ages. In the meeting of glance, Inayat was filled with a feeling of exaltation and the calm and peace, and the atmosphere that the Mahatma had created there were beyond expression. It seemed as if there all the trees, even every leaf, was standing respectfully, motionless, before the Mahatma. It seemed as if the ever-blowing wind was in abeyance under the reign of perfect stillness caused by the peace of his soul. Inayat sang to that Mahatma and received in return a blessing through his inspiring glass. After that, Inayat frequented the place, sometimes with his Veena, and won the favor of the Mahatma. The light, strength, and peace that Inayat received from him designed the career which was destined for him. Wow. Really quite extraordinary. And of course, he had no clue himself as to what that career would be. But in retrospect, he saw that it all came from the inspiring glance of this remarkable being. There was another man whom he met in Kathmandu, and this is the first mention that he makes of meeting any Sufis, even though his own family, of course, had been Sufis for many generations. But he never talks about Mullah Bash's teacher or his father's teacher, nothing like that. But here in Kathmandu, he said, lived a very old Sufi, a fakir, which means a person who has accepted voluntary poverty, who was a spiritual guide to the Raja Bhim Shamshir, the king. The Sufi was from Punjab, and he had a most beautiful personality. His presence was mercy and compassion itself. Inayat was greatly drawn to him, and this Sufi in return was much attracted by Inayat. Inayat frequently visited his dwelling and conversed with him on human life Eniad's contact with him was most helpful. Eniad observed all he did, listened to all he said, and thought and pondered over his visit to this Sufi, and always felt in his soul the exaltation of blessing he received there. This was all training toward the fulfillment of the purpose of his life. So this was when he was only 15 years old. He had these remarkable experiences. When they returned to Baroda, after a long stay, it was nearly a year that they stayed in Kathmandu, but when they returned to Baroda, Eniad had been revivified and took a very active role in the Dayan Shala, the great music school that his grandfather had founded, and which is still there and still very active, one of the leading music schools in India. And as a young man, his enthusiasm was so great that he would often, not only did he teach classes himself, but he would often go to the classrooms of other teachers and offer to take over the class for them, which they readily allowed him to do because, as every teacher knows, a visiting teacher gets the attention of the students much more than the regular teacher ever does. And during this period, he also wrote a series of manuals about playing of different instruments. And all of these manuals we have. They've been translated into English, and they're available in a box set from Baroda even now. And later on, he wrote a poetic discourse called the Minkari Musikar in Urdu, which is, I'm told, an extremely remarkable document. So he was already a writer and lecturer so early in his life. But soon, the Gayan Shala became too small a venue for his work, and he began to travel to go to the musical gatherings of the Maharajas in different parts of India. They were in the form of contests between musicians, competitions between musicians, and consistently, in every case, Eniad won the top award, which consisted of a gold medal. So as he traveled around to the various courts and gathered these medals, there was one ultimate goal, which was the court of Hyderabad. The Nizam of Hyderabad was the most powerful ruler in India at the time of the Raj, and Hyderabad, which was a large district of India, was never under the Raj. It was never conquered by the British, and actually, something quite surprised me when I read it, I had no idea, when India became independent in 1948, the Nizam refused to join, and they actually had to fight a war against the Nizam to incorporate that area into India. The Nizam was fabulously wealthy. It was a legend, his great collections of jewels and all of these things. And he also had the most splendid court anywhere in India, which was considered to be the acme of the artistic side of India. And so the greatest honor that you could have was to play before the Nizam of Hyderabad. So in all his travels around, he had the ultimate goal of eventually going to Hyderabad and playing before the Nizam. So after a considerable period of time, he arrived there, and he immediately made a number of friends, but he found that the court of the Nizam, like the court of the king of Nepal, was very full of political intrigue, and you didn't get in there very easily, and there was no apparent way for him to be able to play before the Nizam. He tried every possible avenue, and they were all closed. And this is actually where the story, legendary or not, about Hazrat Babajan comes in. And that is that one day with a friend, he was going down a street, and sitting by the side of the street was an old hag, a holy woman indeed, but somebody of very unprepossessing appearance, and that on seeing Eniad, this woman took some food that she was chewing, I don't know what it was, She was chewing on something. She took it out of her mouth and offered it to Inayat. Inayat, who, as you see, was an extremely fastidious young man, very well-dressed, elegant, appointed, was horrified at the idea of eating something out of the mouth of this old woman. But his friend urged him. He said, yes, yes, it will be a great blessing. You must do it. And so with great reluctance, Inayat accepted the food and put it into his own mouth. And from that moment, the doors started to open. Eventually, it was actually the Nizam used to go out into the countryside sometime. He used to go camping in the countryside sometimes. But his going camping in the countryside involved hundreds, if not thousands, of people making preparations and everything of this kind. They put up these magnificent tents and all of these things. He was going out to visit some Sufi shrine away from the city. And it so happened that in this encampment, a friend of Inayat's was able to introduce him to the man who was the prime minister to the Nizam, who was himself a Sufi and was very deeply moved by Inayat's singing, and opened the door for him actually to sing for the Nizam out there in the wilderness. The Nizam also was completely taken with this music, and therefore invited him to come and sing before the court. So a few weeks later, when they were back in Hyderabad, Inayat went to the court and sang for the Nizam and the court. The Nizam, who had great, great respect for artistic brilliance, as soon as Inayat began to sing, stood up. And that, of course, meant that everyone else in the court had to stand up. You couldn't be sitting down while the Nizam was standing up. And when Inayat finished one piece of music, the Nizam nodded his head, asking for another and another and another. The people in the court must have been thoroughly exhausted because they had to stand through this entire performance. But then when finally it was enough, the Nizam took a large emerald ring off of his own finger, his own ring, and put it on Inayat's finger. We still have this ring. It's in Pirzia's possession. And named him Tan Sen of India. Mm-hmm. Tan Sen was the great singer in the court of the Emperor Akbar, and was always the gold standard for Indian musicians. So this was the highest honor that it was possible to receive, to be named the Tan Sen of India. And Murshid even used this on his publicity in the early days when he went to the United States for his musical group. But it meant that he had achieved the greatest thing it was possible to achieve as a musician in India. There was no higher honor. That it was like the Nobel Prize or something like that. You couldn't go beyond that. And Inayat, interestingly, then began to lose interest in musical performance. He didn't think of using this as a stepping stone to becoming famous and traveling everywhere and being known as a great musician. He just thought, well, that's finished now. I've done that. And that became the point at which he began to seek for a Sufi teacher. He was clear that his line was the Sufi line. But there were many Sufi teachers in the area around Hyderabad, and he started traveling around. He met many of them. Some of them he considered very authentic, and on more than one occasion he asked someone to become his teacher. And in every case, they said, "Oh no, I'm not worthy. I'm not the right one to do that. Surely, you will find the right person, but it's not me." And he was getting really very frustrated after a while, because this happened over and over again. He spent large amounts of time meditating, particularly in the night. He slept very little, and for most of the night he meditated. And after a while he started to see a face in his meditations. It wasn't a dream, it was in his meditations that he saw a face, a very beautiful face. Someone that he had never met. Well, one night he went to the, I think they call it the Darbar. Anyway, I don't know, but a gathering around a great Sufi teacher named Harold Mubin, who was the best known speaker in that area, very brilliant at giving discourses. And I had often went to his gatherings and had in fact asked him to be his teacher, but had been turned away yet again. And he was sitting in this gathering, and all of a sudden, Harold Mubin interrupted his discourse and said, "Hazrat is coming," and instructed his servants to open the door and to prepare a place next to him for whoever Hazrat might have been. And indeed, a few minutes later, there arrived a man, Sayyid Muhammad Abu Hashim Madani, a person actually very, very little known among the teachers, Sufi teachers in Hyderabad. He was a relatively obscure one. He had only a handful of murids, and he never gave discourses. He never did anything like that. But the man came in and immediately was led over and to sit next to Harold Mubin. And when he looked up, he noticed Inayat sitting there in the audience, and it seemed like he couldn't take his eyes off him. And he turned to Harold Mubin and said, "Who is that young man? He greatly attracts my soul." And Harold Mubin said, "Oh, this young man is a musical genius who is most desirous of receiving your guidance." Right? And immediately, Abu Hashim Madani got up, went over to him, and said, "I have waited for you so long," and initiated him on the spot. Something Sufi teachers never ever do. And so that this was the beginning of his Sufi training.
And I kind of recognized Abu Hashim Madani.
Yes, he recognized that it was the face that he had been seeing in his meditations. I forgot to mention that. Thank you. Yes, he recognized him at once. Seeing in his meditations, I forgot to mention that. At once. So, well, he was a very, very earnest murid. And although he lived in one part of Hyderabad, if you know Hyderabad at all, there's the great ruin of the Golconda Fort. Magnificent place. Inayat lived near there. His teacher actually lived in Secunderabad, which is a kind of twin city to Hyderabad, 7 miles away from where he lived. And yet Inayat went there every day on foot to his teacher's place and sat in his teacher's presence. His teacher always warmly received him, and they would sit and talk. But his teacher never talked about anything spiritual. They would chat about the weather, local politics, all these things, but nothing about anything spiritual. And Inayat, being a proper disciple, never would urge his teacher to speak about anything. He waited and waited and waited, and it was 6 months that he visited him every day without hearing a single thing about anything spiritual. But then one day, suddenly, his teacher started talking about a metaphysical subject. And Inayat was so excited that he got out of his pocket a little notebook and pencil that he carried just in case there should be something to record. And as soon as his teacher saw the notebook and pencil, he changed the subject and started talking about something else. And Inayat said, "I learned from this a great lesson, that these teachings cannot be written in a notebook. They must be written on the heart."
He felt that rather than Abu Hashim Madani having said that.
Oh, yes. No, he didn't say anything about it. He just changed the subject. But Inayat got it, that was the message. You can't write these things down. It's not, it's no point in that. And in fact, curiously enough, Inayat Khan, all his life, had a great suspicion of written things. He didn't recommend reading spiritual books, for example. I'd be willing to bet that if I went to your home, I would see several shelves of spiritual books there. But he didn't really think this was a very good idea. He didn't think you could learn anything from a book. And it's especially odd since he himself wrote many books, or I should say gave lectures which were made into books, but at his instruction. So apparently he wanted to leave this teaching behind to us in written form, but he didn't really think that was a very promising way to learn anything. So in any case, he had a period of 3.5 years of instruction under his murship. And he says that his murship trained him in what is called four school, that is the four major Sufi orders, the Qadiri, the Naqshbandi, the Suhrawardi, and the Shishti. Now, what he means by that is anybody's guess. I don't know. I guess it means that his murshid taught him practices from all of them, because each has its own very distinctive set of practices and its way of proceeding. The Qadiri order, for example, forbids the use of music altogether, whereas in the Shishti order, it's a very important part of spiritual training. But he apparently got them all in some form. And in the practices that he passed on to us, you find a mixture of many, many things. Something that really quite surprised me was that Pirzia said, after spending quite a bit of time in India and meeting all these people and studying with them, taking a long retreat, he said, "I'd always assumed that there were lots more practices and that Murshid just taught us a few of those practices, but if you went back to the place of origin, you would find many, many more practices." He said, quite the contrary. Many of the practices that Murshid passed on had been forgotten by the Sufis in India, and they were fascinated to learn these practices. And in fact, we have more than they do. So this is really quite surprising. But in any case, he did all these practices with great earnestness. He did night vigils very, very, very often. That is, he stayed up for the whole night or most of the night doing practices. But when he mentioned this to his murshid said, "I'm very sorry." He didn't really approve. His murshid did not approve of asceticism. He didn't believe that was the right way to do this, of denying yourself anything or trying to make yourself do extraordinary feats or anything of the kind. He was a very gentle teacher, and in some ways, not a match for the incredible enthusiasm of this young pupil who wanted to do everything as well as it could possibly be done. Inai says that his murshid would habitually say, whenever they parted, would give him a blessing, but the words were, "May your faith increase." And he says, at first he was deeply puzzled by this. I mean, that faith, which he regarded as an inherent quality of the soul, how could it increase? I mean, it just is what it is. But he said, later in life he learned that every situation in life calls for more faith. And that the one who has faith will have every wish granted. So may your faith increase. After his 3.5 years of training, his murshid, who was an elderly man already. By the way, his name, if you see, Sayyid, it means that he was a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. His first name was Muhammad, but he never used that name. Abu Hashim means he's the father of Hashim. Madani means that his family was from Medina originally. He was an Arab living in India. I don't know for how many generations the family had lived there, but he was not an Indian. He was an Arab. And after 3.5 years, his murshid became gravely ill and foresaw that he was going to die. He told his wife 6 months before the exact date on which he was going to die. And during those 6 months, he did something which is very traditional for Sufi teachers. That is to say, he wrote letters. He contacted everyone that he had ever known through his life, and begged for forgiveness for any harm of any kind that he might have done to them. And this is a traditional thing to do, and it's one of the ways that I know that Murshid did not really anticipate that he was going to die in Delhi in 1927, because he didn't do that, and he would have done it if he could have. But in any case, he wrote many, many such letters and sent them out, and it's a very, very, very beautiful practice. And on the day which he had told his wife 6 months before, he gathered everyone in his household, the servants and his family around him, and asked for their forgiveness, gave them a blessing, and asked to be left alone in his room, and he started doing his zikr. And when they next went into the room, he was gone. So, now, what I didn't mention to you is that in some time during this dying process, he had had an interview with Inayat, and he had given him his blessing and Inayat's commission, which is variously reported, but basically in these words: fare forth into the world, my son, and unite East and West in your music. Spread the wisdom of Sufism abroad, for to this end you are gifted by Allah, the Merciful, the Compassionate. And this became the clarification of the mission that Inayat was to undertake in the world. The career that had been designed for him by the Mahatma now began to take a more definite shape. But the thing that you have to understand is that the Murshid was reading the desire in Inayat's soul, because he had wanted to go to the West from the time he was a child, ever since his uncle had gone there and then had come back with glowing reports. He was dying to go to the West. So Murshid didn't tell him to do something he didn't want to do. He told him to do something he desperately did want to do. And it was a wonderful fulfillment. Of course, it wasn't at all clear what he would do once he got to the West, as he was a musician. He was not a teacher. He hadn't taught anyone up until this point, and it wasn't clear that was what he would become. And probably, I imagine, he envisioned it in the first instance that he would go as a musician and unite East and West in his music. That was the first part of the commission, and in fact he did so. But I'm getting ahead of the story here, because Abu Hashim Madani died in 1907, and Inayat Khan left for the West in 1910. So the first question would be, well, why didn't he just go right away? And the answer is a fairly simple one, but one that you couldn't understand if you were not Indian, and that is that his father was still alive. Rama Khan was still alive in Baroda. And so during this period, twice he went to visit his father in Baroda. One time when he visited his father and they were talking, his father said, "Oh, how I wish that I were young so that I could sit at your feet and learn all that you have to teach." And Inayat said, "Father, please do not say such a thing. It embarrasses me." But in any case, he didn't go back to live in Baroda. He visited Baroda. And in fact, after a long tour, another kind of, not a musical tour in this case, but a tour of what he calls the holy men of India, he went to visit all of the great gurus that he had heard about and listened to them. He didn't ask them questions. He didn't, in most cases, even converse with them. He just went to imbibe their wisdom, knowing that he was going to be leaving. And so he had to take it all in. It was not only Sufi teachers, but Hindu teachers as well, particularly Hindu teachers. And one can say, really, Inayat Khan's Sufism was always shot through with a deep strain of Hindu teachings as well. It was never limited to an Islamic tradition. And you may know that the Sufi teachers in India, particularly in the Shishti order, have always been very open to Hindus. Many Sufi teachers, Shishti teachers, took Hindu pupils without asking them to become Muslims. The going beyond the bounds of strict Islam, it was nothing new, although, of course, Inayat carried it to another degree, another level, when he came to the West, because he never, ever asked anyone to become a Muslim. He did ask Rabia Martin to learn the Islamic prayers, but he didn't ask her to become a Muslim. And maybe that was because she was Jewish, and it may have taken something special to open her to Islam. I don't know what he had in mind, but he did ask that. He never asked anybody else to do that, as far as I know. And so, as I said, he took it to another level, and we'll talk about that later on. But what he did do after his tour of the Holy Men of India was to settle in Calcutta. And there he made many contacts, primarily with the Tagore family. He came to know Rabindranath Tagore quite well during that period, and other members of the Tagore family became his patrons. He traveled around in Bengal to various courts and played for the Rajas and Maharajas there, and at least two of them asked him to come and be their court musician and to live in the court, but he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to be beholden to anyone or work for anyone. And so he had the idea that he would create in Calcutta a music school on the model of the Gayanshala that his grandfather had created in Baroda. And he was working toward that end when he was called back to Baroda because his father was dying. And it was once his father had died and been buried that he was liberated to carry out his Murshid's commission. He couldn't have left India while his father was still alive. That wouldn't have been respectful to his father. And so it was at that point that he began laying his plans. He asked his younger brother Mahbub Khan to accompany him, which he was very willing to do, and also they call him a cousin brother. He was a kind of distant relation to the family, but had come to Baroda and lived with the family for quite some time. A man named Muhammad Ali Khan, who was also a very fine musician. He had a very remarkable voice, and so the three of them got on a ship in Bombay, not on September 13th, 1910, which is the day that we've been taught to celebrate as the Hijrat Day, the day of his emigration, because we haven't been able to nail it down exactly, but there wasn't any ship that left Bombay for the West on that day. There are records for these things. And we don't even know what ship he was on, but in any case, it wasn't on that date. September 13th may be, most probably, the day he left Baroda, the late day he left his hometown to go to Bombay, Mumbai, and get the ship to go to the West. But in any case, the three of them booked passage on the ship from Mumbai to New York. It was a long journey in those days. It took nearly a month, three and a half weeks to get from India, and of course they went through the Suez Canal and the Mediterranean. They stopped some places in Italy, but eventually ended up in New York in October of 1910, and at that moment begins another chapter in this story. And Icon seemed to always be perfectly self-confident. He never seemed to have any doubt about himself or his work, with one exception, and I'd like to begin the story of his time in the West with that exception. It's from the very beginning of what is called the autobiography in the biography. I was transported by destiny.
from the world of lyric and poetry to the world of industry and commerce on the 13th of September, 1910. I tried to think where I was going, why I was going, what I was going to do, what was in store for me. How shall I get to work? Will the people be favorable or unfavorable to the message which I am taking from one end of the world to the other? It seemed my mind moved curiously on these questions, but my heart refused to ponder upon them even for a moment, answering apart one constant voice I always heard coming from within, urging me constantly onward to my task, saying, "Thou art sent on our service, and it is we who will make thy way clear." This alone was my consolation. So, as you know, undoubtedly, learning to hear the voice of God within is the whole point of all Sufi training. That's it. Once you can hear the voice of God within, you don't need any training. You listen to the voice of God within. Even meditation. Someone asked Merchant, said, "Well, isn't meditation an artificial thing to do?" And instead of answering the way we would, "Oh, no," Merchant said, "Oh, yes, of course it's artificial. But that's because we have become so artificial that we must use an artificial means to become natural." So his life in the West began in New York City. They landed there in October. And for the first time in their entire lives, they were in a really cold place. Now, we don't think of New York as particularly cold, but if you had came from India, you would think it was very, very cold. And so, first of all, they didn't have the right clothes for that climate. They didn't have anything. They had brought a limited amount of money with them. Their family was wealthy, and they were able to bring money, and they continued to receive money from Baroda for years after that. But they didn't have enough with them to face the kind of expenses they had in New York. Things were much more expensive than they had imagined, and life was not too easy. They didn't have any real entree to New York. They didn't know anybody, except that they had one reference to a man from Baroda who was living there, who knew a professor at Columbia University of Music. And they were put in contact with him, and he arranged a concert for them and was very favorable. And things slowly started to open, but they were really, really difficult in the early days. They were struggling. They had enough money to eat and for a cold water flat, so to speak, but they didn't really have anything to do. They were unfamiliar with the culture. They didn't really know how to make their way, but then another concert was arranged, and it so happened that the great dancer Ruth St. Denis attended the concert, was very taken with the Indian music. Now, something you have to understand is that nobody in America had ever heard any Indian music before. It was completely unknown to them. They didn't even know there was music in India. And they were not ready to hear it. It was too strange to their ears. So it was only a very small elite circle that would be able to make anything at all out of this music. But it so happened that Miss Ruth, as everyone called her, Ruth St. Denis, had recently invented some Indian dances. She was into creating all different kinds of ethnic dances. And she invented some Indian dances, and she was very taken with the idea that she might have real Indian musicians to accompany her in these dances. And so she approached them and hired them, and they became part of her traveling company. So this was great good fortune, because it meant that they got to travel all over the United States, something they wouldn't have even known where to go before that, but they just went wherever she had dates. It was all set up. They were well paid, by the company. And while they were on the train, Inayakan actually showed Ruth St. Denis quite a few things about Indian dance, about which she knew absolutely nothing. She just made up these dances out of her own head without any basis whatsoever. But Murshid showed her some things about the way Indian dance is really done. I mean, he was not a teacher of dance, obviously, but he knew something about it. He'd seen a lot of dance and so forth. And so they had marvelous travels around all over the United States. But it so happened in San Francisco that a very interesting woman named Ada Martin was in his audience. She was of Jewish extraction, I guess you would say, but was very interested in different religions, had studied many things, and was really looking for a real teacher. And she was just really very taken with Murshid's presentation. She wrote him a beautiful letter requesting an interview, but unfortunately Murshid was already scheduled to leave by train for Seattle the next day, and so we communicated with her, and she actually came and took the train. And on that train, on the way to Seattle, he initiated her as his first follower in the West, his first murid. Probably his first murid anywhere, because there's no mention of any murids in India at that time. Later on there were. And gave her the name Rabia after the greatest early Sufi saint, the one who actually defined Sufism as the path of love. And that ever since has been the Sufi path, the path of love. So He began to train her, and he trained her very, very thoroughly. Not that he stayed there very long, but he started exchanging letters with her on a very frequent basis, in which he gave her exercises to do. Then she would report back to him. He was very pleased with the progress that she made. He pushed her to go faster and faster, and she did. She rose to the occasion. And within less than a year after they had met, he gave her the initiation as a murshida, the first murshida in the Sufi order. There wasn't even any Sufi order yet then, but the first murshida. And the first murshida by a long ways, because there wasn't another one until 1923. And he consistently referred to her as the mother of the message. In fact, in his letters to her, as Shabda can tell you, he just addressed her as mother. So she was a very, very important person to Murshid. And perhaps the biggest mystery is why he took so long to come back to America, because once he left in 1912, he didn't come back again until 1923. There's an 11-year gap. And if you look at their correspondence, he's constantly planning to go there. I mean, of course, not during the war, but then afterwards. But something always happens, and it was delayed and delayed and delayed until it finally actually happened. By that time, she had a large flourishing center in San Francisco, many murids, among them Samuel Lewis, who met Murshid when he came in 1923 and then again in 1926. So, what happened with Inayatan and his brothers? Mushrap had not yet come. He joined them in New York later on. But after Seattle, then they traveled back again across the country to New York, because the impresario who had arranged the tour with Ruth St. Denis was very interested in arranging a tour just for them, for the Royal Musicians of Hindustan, and this was very promising, very exciting possibility. And so they returned to New York in order to meet with him and work out the contract, and et cetera, et cetera. And it so happened that this man was on the Titanic and didn't make it. So that was the end of those plans.
Wow.